Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism Department, preparing the next generation of bold and talented journalists. UAF Journalism. Tell great stories.
It's tough when Hollywood calls. You kind of don't know what to do at first. Your instinct is to give them whatever they want. It's like the most popular girl in high school calling you up out of the blue. Whatever she's calling about, you're gonna help. The first time Hollywood called me, they were looking for a reality TV show subject up here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was pretty pumped and did a lot of hunting trying to find them a good person to do a reality TV show on. But they didn't like anyone I found them, which of course added to my sense of unworthiness. The next time Hollywood called, they wanted help finding someone who lived in a dry cabin. You see, we've got these cabins up here that don't have any running water, and they're pretty novel to folks in the lower 48. This was one of those house hunter type shows, and they wanted to take someone who already lived in a dry cabin, have them pretend to go dry cabin hunting for the cameras, and then pick the one they already lived in. Man, I worked hard to find them somebody. I sent them all sorts of names, but do you know what happened? They did the show. Used one of the people I sent them, but never thanked me or even told me when they were coming up to shoot. Man, did I feel used. And so that's when I decided I wasn't going to do this anymore. I was no longer going to be the northern yokel who dropped everything every time there was a Hollywood area code on my caller ID. I figured, if people wanted to hear stories about Alaska, then it should be Alaskans who are sharing those stories. And so that's what you're getting right now. This is the pilot episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. All the storytellers you're going to hear are Alaskans telling stories that happened right here in Alaska, and I'm proud to bring them to you. In this episode, I picked out three of my favorite stories from our first ever Dark Winter Nights live storytelling event at the Pioneer Park Civic Center Theater. Up first is one of the funniest and most genuine people I know. Ladies and gentlemen, Melissa Buchto.
Okay, so let me just start by saying I love Alaska. I do. I really do. I've loved growing up here. I love living here. And when I say that living in our state is like living in a postcard or living in those travel brochures that we pass around to get all the tourists to come up here and everything, it's true. I mean, it really is true. Our state really does look like that. And I love it a lot. But it can be really difficult living here for someone who is partially blind, like myself. So a little bit about myself. I am what is considered legally blind, so I'm not sighted enough for the sighted people, but I'm not blind enough for the blind people either. I walk this really weird line of this just really weird gray area, just is kind of where I'm living. And when you're growing up here in this state, you know, your parents probably own a motorhome or a camper or a big van or a car or something, and you do what everybody does. You go on road trips. Road trips are great. You can bond with your family. You get lots of awesome stories and everything. But, you know, you're mostly, when you're in Alaska, you go on a road trip to see the wildlife, to see the scenery, because it's awesome. A lot of that is lost on someone who can't see. Did you know that blind people get in national parks for free? That's really great. Think about that for a second. Because really, what's a blind person going to do in a national park? I mean, everyone's like, oh, look, McKinley is so beautiful. Look at Denali. It's great. I can't touch Denali. Denali's not going to say something. I can't go like, you know, hey, Denali, how's it going?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
That's not going to happen. I can't go to Yellowstone and touch Old Faithful either. I can't really get very close to Old Faithful. I can hear it, so I guess that's pretty cool. I've never been to the Grand Canyon either, but I'm pretty sure that would also be lost on me. It's deep. Yay! Fantastic! Can we go eat some tacos? So, and of course, you know, like I said, you know, the wildlife. That's another really big thing about road trips here and living in Alaska. all the beautiful wildlife. You got your moose, your seals, your puffins, your polar bears, your brown bears, wolves. It's gorgeous. I love it. It's great. And we go on these road trips, and we bring our binoculars and everything, and we go, my parents loved going down to Seward, because it was so lush and beautiful, and it was close, much closer than Denali. And they'd go, oh, look at the eagles, look at the dull sheep sitting up there on the mountains, oh, they're so beautiful. And we'd pull off to these overlooks, you know, to see the belugas and everything, my mom would put these giant binoculars up to my face and try in vain to point my head in the direction that she thought the wildlife was. So we're sitting here, you know, she's like, look, it's over here. And my dad and my brother just basically out of sheer embarrassment and or pity would just kind of sidestep away. We don't know these people. And people would come up and tap my dad on the shoulder and go, you know, do you know that woman? It looks like she's abusing her child. So I decided, because I was sick and tired of having my neck wrenched around by my mother, and I was sick and tired of my parents being so darn disappointed that I couldn't see anything because they were like, we're not fulfilling your life, we're not giving you a good time. And I really, really wanted them to know that I appreciated all that they were doing and then this experience and everything. So I decided to lie to my parents. I just figured, why not? I'm just gonna, everybody will be happy. So whenever we would see an eagle or a dull sheep or a bear, I'd put my binoculars up to my face and go, wow! That's amazing! It's so cool! And I couldn't really be that specific because, you know, I couldn't be like, oh, look at it reach into the stump and just like, but that's a boulder. Right, but the bear! So what I would do is I would pretend to see all these things and I'd have like stock footage from the Discovery Channel going in my head. Because, you know, I know what a bear looks like. So, yeah. One day, we went and took our annual summer road trip. We ended up in Seward. Seward, Alaska. It's a little harbor town, for those of you who might not have been. It's where all the wildlife boats and cruises go out of and everything. So we got on this boat, and we're all excited, and I'm super excited. I want to see a whale, you know? I want to see an orca. I love orca whales. I think they're beautiful creatures, and I think they're amazing. And that's what I wanted to see when we got on this boat. And of course, we get on the boat, you know, 2 hours later, just doing our thing. We've seen seals and puffins, and we saw a bear even, and we saw dolphins. It was great. It was a really great day. We were lucky to get to see all this wildlife. And of course, we saw glaciers and beautiful scenery, which is easy for me to see because glaciers don't move very fast. And they make noise sometimes, which is nice. Very nice. Glacier, the most accessible of the Alaskan scenery, if you're blind. So we're going along in this boat, and we're doing our thing, and I decided instead of feeling upset and down about seeing all these animals, I would just learn to experience and have fun on this cruise in my own way. So I'd stand on the bow of the boat, and I would hold on to the boat railings and feel the perspiration and the cold water of the metal on my hands. And I felt the boat going up and down and up and down and rocking from side to side. So I would enjoy that feeling. I'd look at the rock formations as they would drift in and out of the mist as we would go past them. I let the wind go through my hair. It was beautiful. And I was really, really enjoying myself. And I thought, you know, even if I don't see a whale, I've had an incredible day. Well, we were about to go back to the harbor, and we pulled off into this cove because the captain had got a radio call from another ship that there was a pod of orcas in this cove. And so we pull up into this cove, and everybody is real quiet, you know, and the captain's like, okay, if we see whales, don't scream and point, because then you'll just scare them away, you know. And so everyone's out of the cabins on the boat, and we're all on the railings, and this was like a triple-decker boat. It was a big boat, so all three decks full of people. And we see them. There are this pod of orca whales, and they're just hanging out in this cove. And they kind of disappear into the water, and the captain pulls up and he shuts the boat engine off. We're all really, really quiet. And the whales decide to swim over towards our boat. So we're all looking at these whales. And we're all just waiting. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. I'm standing there. I got my binoculars. And I'm just thinking about whales, you know, in my head. I just saw Free Willy. So I'm putting those images in there, you know, just getting ready for another yay. But the whales surrounded our boat, and right in front of me comes this dorsal fin. This beautiful, black, proud dorsal fin comes slowly up out of the water, right, you know, right in front of me, probably about to the end of this stage, you know, and I can see about 3 feet in front of me before everything starts to get really blurry. So this whale comes up. And I can see it's right in front of me. I can see the white marks above the whale's eyes. And I can see the white marks from the belly that kind of come up on the back. I can see the whale's tail. And I just stood there. I was holding on to the railing so tight. My knuckles were turning white. And I was just so afraid that if I moved or did anything or second-guessed myself, that the whale would just disappear. But the whale didn't. We just kind of stood there in each other's space, just sensing each other and looking at each other. And I can just remember thinking to myself, wow, finally, I'm here. We're here together. And I looked at the whale and I whispered so that no one else could hear, thank you. Thank you for letting me be here with you. Thank you for letting me see you. I didn't even have to use my binoculars. I was so happy. And I knew that when we got back to the docks, I wasn't going to have to lie to my parents this time about seeing something that I really, really, really wanted to see. Now, granted, the next day I went back to lying to my parents. And I still lie to my parents to this day, actually, about seeing wildlife. We've just kind of come to accept it. It's our thing. Thank you.
I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of camping. I don't sleep well, it always seems like it's raining, and I hate the midnight treks to the outhouse. Our next storyteller isn't a fan of camping either, but he's got a much better reason for it. Ladies and gentlemen, James Meniker.
Well, I was bummed. My whole family was bummed, actually. It was 1984. I was 10 years old. I had two younger brothers. One was 9, one was 5. And my dad had just bought a piece of property out off of 26 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road. And he was going to take us out there on a nice long weekend to explore the property. And we had been planning this for a month or so. And the week leading up to it, it rained nonstop. And we were all just feeling bummed. My mom especially, because she lived in a house full of 4 guys, and she was really excited about being able to have a nice, long, quiet weekend. The Thursday before we were going to leave, the rain stopped and the skies cleared, and my dad said, "It is game on. We are going tomorrow." We were so excited because we were confident that the rain would not bother us anymore on this trip. And then. So we load up into the truck, my dad's old red and white Dodge pickup truck that he had driven for 15 years. We load the canoe on top of it. We load it up with supplies and camping gear and everything you need for a long weekend of hiking and exploring. We put my dad in the driver's seat, and the three of us get into the cab, and off we go. And my mom is waving, smiling, tears of joy coming down her face as she has a pile of books that will not be interrupted. So as we drive out to Chena Hot Springs Road, we find our turnoff, and we go down this winding, gravelly, bumpy road, the kind they still have there. And we come down to the river, and we're like, this looks like a great place to set up camp. The river's, I won't lie, the river's high. It's swollen, but it looks like all we'll set up our camp for the evening, and then we'll go across tomorrow. It'll be great. So we get our camp set up round about 4:35 in the afternoon, and we notice the river's higher than it used to be. Well, okay, so we'll move farther up the road. That's not a problem. By the time we get our camp taken down, the river is noticeably higher. So we move substantially farther up the road and get the tent up and get the fire going. And it keeps following us, this river. We decide maybe we should find another camping spot. And so as we're taking down the tent, by the time we get camp taken down the second time and loaded into the truck, the fire has been put out by the river. Haste might be required here. So, again, we load everything up into the truck. Dad gets in and drives. The three of us load into the cab, and we start driving up the road to get back on the Chena Hot Springs Road, go find a better camping spot. We come around a bend, and we see that ahead of us, the river has jumped its banks and is coming down the road at us. My dad sits there idling for a moment, wondering what he should do. He decides chains will probably be the best solution, because chains really help in driving up river. And so he gets out and he puts on the chains, muttering to himself. We three are sitting in there like, this is not what we were expecting to see. So as Dad gets all chained up, he's like, okay, boys, here we go. We start driving up the road. Pretty soon we're driving up the river. The water's coming up, and he tells my brother, John, who's the 9-year-old, sitting closest to the window, okay, son, I want you to climb out the window and sit on the cab. And when debris comes down river at us, I want you to push it out of the way. So here's my brother John, kicking his feet on the truck, pushing out sticks and making sure that nothing torpedoes us. And we're going. We're driving up river. Finally, we start to float. My dad realizes the chains may not be able to save him this time and says, abandon truck, it's time to go. So we climb out the windows. He takes the canoe off of the top of the truck, sets it onto the road / river. We put the boys into it. We put whatever supplies we can in the back, and we start paddling up road. And we watch the truck go down behind us. So we're going up the rapids and paddling upstream, and we're going up and down and around, and we come to a high point where it's dry, and my dad decides this would be a good place to camp and have a little break. So we have a nice little view of our truck disappearing under the water as we make our hot chocolate and make sure everybody's well accounted for. And then we decide, no, we should go home. So we load into the canoe and go down road again. Finally, we come to dry land, and we just leave the canoe. We leave all the supplies, and we start to walk back to Fairbanks. It is, by this time, it's 10:30 p.m. or so. It's dark. There's nothing going on. And so we are walking down Chena Hot Springs Road with not a car in sight. Finally, we come up to one of the general stores. It's closed, but my dad decides I'm going to make a phone call. So he goes and pounds on the door, and light comes on. They open up, and he explains the situation, and they say, of course, you can call. The phone rings at home, and my mother, who has been giggling to herself all day and reading her mystery novels in her pajamas in bed, gets the call that, hi, honey. So we lost the truck and we need a ride. We're coming home. Love you. Bye. So my mom comes out and gets us. We all load into the car. It is a very quiet ride home. So we get home. Everybody collapses. A few days later, we head on out to try and salvage the truck, see what'll happen. So we get some friends, get a winch, and we go and we find the truck, and we hook up to it and pull it out. They drain the fluids. They put new oil, put new gas in. My dad drives it home and drives it for the next 10 years. And that's why I hate camping to this day. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you remember, but before there were reality TV shows about Alaska, there was this program on TV back in the 90s called Northern Exposure. When I first came up to Alaska, people told me living up here was just like the TV show. That didn't turn out to be the case for me, but it was pretty close for our next storyteller. Wendy Demess tells this story about a Jewish girl moving from New Jersey to the tiny village of Wales, Alaska. Population, 120.
I remember it vividly. It was August 2nd, 2000, and I was on the smallest plane I had ever been on in my life. 10 seats, 8 of which were taken up by young kids that were coming back from church camp out in Nome, the pilot, and myself in the co-pilot seat. It was a clear day, but it was really windy, and I mean windy. We were leaving Nome, and in a small plane like that, you can feel just about everything. We landed in a few villages, and when we finally arrived, as we were coming into Wales, the pilot was telling me, you know, out there, you see the two islands out there, that's the Diomede Islands, and the small one is is America, and just a mile further is Big Diomede Island, and that's Russia. The international dateline runs between. I said, oh, I didn't realize that on a clear day we actually could see Russia. So we buzzed over the village. He said, well, we're just going to let everybody know we're arriving because the airport in Wales, Alaska is just an airstrip. That's it. There's no buildings, just an airstrip. And so we buzzed the village and we came in for a landing. And I noticed as we were coming in that there was a broken plane on the right side of the runway. And there was a broken plane on the left side of the runway. And I looked at the pilot and I said, what happened? And he said, oh, well, there were a couple of, you know, inexperienced pilots, didn't know how the crosswinds work up here on the peninsula. And he said, it's nothing to worry about. Nobody was seriously injured. And I'm like, so you've been flying up here for a long time then? And he said, oh, you know, a couple of months. But we landed safely, I was happy to say. And, well, I'm here, so. As the plane came to a stop, I noticed that there were a bunch of people there to greet the kids that were getting off the plane. And there was a teacher that I was introduced to, a gentleman named Eric, who was a returning teacher in the village. And he came to welcome me, as well as this gentleman named Frank, who was the school's maintenance man. And he brought with him his four-wheeler and a trailer behind his four-wheeler to lug all of my stuff to my new apartment that I was going to be staying in. And so as Frank was helping me load my luggage, I had a couple of suitcases, an oversized fish box filled with halibut that I caught in Valdez the week before. He asked me, what's in the box? And I said, oh, well, there's halibut. He's like, all of it? And I said, well, there's a little bit of dry ice and some butter, but it's pretty much all halibut. And on the way to my apartment, I said, so Frank, how far is my apartment from the school? And he says, oh, about quarter mile, couple of months be half mile. And I thought he was just pulling my leg, but I'll get back to that. So Frank very kindly helped me load everything into my apartment. And I was first wanting to unload the fish box, hoping that everything had stayed frozen for the 2-day travel. So I was loading the halibut into the freezer. I'd been in the house, the apartment, for maybe 15 minutes or so, and I hear a on the door. And I open the door, and there's Frank with the hind end of a reindeer on his shoulder and a big smile on his face. And I'm talking belly, butt, legs, just up on his shoulder. And he says, "Where'd you want it?" I was like, "Well, the kitchen sink, I guess." I mean, so he popped it in the kitchen sink, and we decided how much halibut he was going to take with him, and he left with a really big smile. And about 10 minutes later, I'm still loading stuff into the freezer, and I'm thinking about what I'm going to do with this deer in my sink, and I hear another on the door. And so I go and open the door, and there's this long gray-haired gentleman standing in the doorway there, and he says, "My name's Clifford. I hear you have halibut for trade." And I said, "Well, yeah, I do." And he says, "Well, I have some walrus." I'm like, I'm a Jewish girl from Jersey. I have no idea what to do with walrus. Is it good? And he's like, "Oh, it's real good. You'll love it." I said, "Well, why not?" So he trades me some halibut for some walrus and leaves with a big smile. And about 15 minutes later, there's another on my door. And so I opened the door, and it was a local pastor from the Lutheran church there. And he introduced himself and said, you know, welcomed me to the community and said, "You know, I hear you have some halibut for trade." And I said, "Yeah, I do." He says, "I have some muskox roasts. Would you be interested?" And I'm like, "Sure, why not?" So I trade him for some muskox, and he leaves with a smile and a thank you and everything. And about 10 minutes after that, there's yet another on my door. And I open the door, and this woman introduces herself. She says, "My name's Lena. I'm an elder in the community, and I'm inviting you for your first Eskimo dinner." And I said, "Well, great." She goes, "I live two doors that way." I said, "Super." I said, "What time is dinner? What time should I get there?" And she says, "Dinner starts when you get there." I said, "Super." So I had been in town for about an hour. I'd met a handful of locals. I'd met one of the teachers. I'd met the minister as well. And I had a freezer that was half filled with halibut, muskox, walrus meat, and I had the hind end of Rudolph in my sink. It was a pretty good first night. So the next morning, I decided I should probably call back to Jersey, let my folks know everything was all right and all. My mother and I are talking, and I explained to her, you know, the broken planes on the side of the runway and, of course, having walrus my first night in town. And she says, "Wendy, they don't have roads? What do you mean they don't have roads to get there? You couldn't drive? And they have broken planes? They didn't get rid of the planes? What's wrong with them? That's crazy." And I say, "You ate walrus? Is it kosher?" She obviously didn't get it. The other experience during that time in Wales that really kind of hit home with me was during the Thanksgiving Day holiday. They had a big potlatch at the school, and I really wanted to contribute to the potlatch. So about a month before, I had gotten a hold of my folks and asked my mom if she could send me a care package with some matzo ball soup mix and all the fixings. And she did, and it got there on time, which was a good thing. And so I made all the matzo balls at home the evening before, and I brought that into the school and went in quite early in the morning and took one of the big pots that they had in the kitchen there and started cooking a huge pot of matzo ball soup. And I was cooking. As it was almost ready, Lena kept coming into the kitchen saying, "What you cooking? What you cooking, Wendy?" And I said, "Well, you'll see. It'll be done soon." So when it was finally finished, I brought it out and I set it on the table with all of the other food out there in the cafeteria. And Lena was the first one to the pot. She takes off the lid and she grabs the ladle and starts stirring. She's got her eyebrows all scrunched down. She says, "What's that floating in the soup?" And I said, "Well, they're kind of like dumplings. They're called matzo balls." I said, "You fed me walrus my first night in town. Try it." And she took a little bowl, and she had one matzo ball, and she stepped aside. And seemed like everybody was watching her. And she dug in, and she took one spoonful, and her eyes lit up a little bit, and she went right back and filled up her bowl. And she ate that soup, and I'm proud to say that I fed 120 Eskimos matzo ball soup, and I've got video footage to prove it. That was pretty cool. It was a really good experience. I'm glad I had an opportunity to live in Wales and partake in the culture there, and it's something I'll never forget. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the pilot episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. I really hope you enjoyed it because we've got a lot more stories for you. Audio recording for our live event was by John Hoff of Alaska Universal Productions. Special thanks to Karin McElroy for connecting me with Wendy DeMess. Audio and story consultation by Lori Neufeld. And all the music you heard in this episode was by Thought Trade, based right here in Fairbanks, Alaska. You can find a link to all their music at darkwinternights.com. These are the stories we tell up here in Alaska, and these are the stories we tell on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince. Would you like to see Dark Winter Nights live and in person? Dark Winter Nights is going to be live on stage Saturday, November 22nd at 8 p.m. in the Pioneer Park Civic Center Theater in Fairbanks, Alaska. Get more information at darkwinternights.com.
Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism Department, preparing the next generation of bold and talented journalists. UAF Journalism. Tell great stories. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dark Winter Nights. Want more Alaska stories? Check out the Dark Winter Nights podcast, available now on iTunes or online at darkwinternights.com. We need your Alaska stories. If you've got a great story to tell or know someone who does, head over to darkwinternights.com, where you can submit your idea and get more information about the program.